Hi, I'm Amon.
And I'm Lena.
And I'm Ruman.
Whoa! We have another person here!
Wait, Ruman? Did you say Ruman or Ryan?
Yeah, my name is Ryan Joe. I'm an ace reporter for Business Insider.
Oh, and
also
good.
The co-host of Quarantine Comics.
Oh, I'm glad we got okay. The good one.
All right.
Wait.
Jokes aside, we don't have Ryan from Quarantine Comics here. Instead, we have Ruman Segal from Quarantine Comics, friend of Grounded Geeks.
You guys are my top podcast when I am doing the dishes, folding laundry, and want to hear people smarter than me yelling at each other about comics.
That's truly one of the nicest things we've heard.
Quarantine Comics.
Yes, we do. And also your other podcast, Modern Minorities, just got to say that.
Aww.
Shout out to Modern Minorities. But welcome, Ruman. Welcome to Grounded Geeks. We are so excited to have you. And today,
I'm so glad I passed the test.
Barely, but yeah, we'll have you. And today we are talking about a graphic novel called Squire by Nadia Shamas and Sarah Alfaji. It is so exciting. And just, I mean, the art alone, the cover alone just had me. I was obsessed with it the moment I saw the cover of this graphic novel. So let's dive right in.
What, really quick, yeah. Is there any angle to it being a quote-unquote Muslim comic or Muslim-inspired comic, or does that come out later in the conversation? Like, why you were excited to read it?
Oh, I think I immediately recognized that it had, like, a Middle Eastern Arab feel to it, like, just from the cover somehow. And then I saw, I think I must have seen Sarah tweeting about it, and I don't know how. Maybe someone else that I follow, like, follows her, and that's how she came up on my feed.
Got it.
Yeah, Muslim Twitter, exactly. So that's I think. And then I think when I saw
you
obviously her face,
sorry,
I was like, oh,
joke.
Hijabi that girl. Okay. So, yeah.
I had no idea this existed because I am too old for Twitter, apparently. I only heard about it when Lena told me about it. But reading it, I didn't pick up any Muslim-y stuff, but a lot of very, very Arab, Middle East culture stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. I think of, like, we're kind of full into it now, but, like, I almost kind of view, because my dad, while he was raised Hindu, he studied Islamic architecture. That was one of his specialties as an architecture student in India. And I've always viewed, like, separate the two words, Muslim as being more religious and faith-driven, and Islam, even though I know it's the name of the faith, but, like, when I think about architecture and literature and poetry, I use the word Islam. So it's kind of like the book felt more Islamic than Muslim to me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I see what you're saying with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I understand what you mean by the differentiation that you're saying, but your vocabulary is incorrect in a sense, but it's also right in a sense. So if you talk about Islamic architecture, Muslim architecture, Muslim design from India to North Africa, all the way to Spain, you will see cultural differences. Mm-hmm. The thing that makes it sort of the driving force behind what makes it Muslim or Islamic architecture is that in Islam, or at least the way people have interpreted it over the centuries, over the millennia, is that you can't portray people and real life things. So a lot of that architecture and design, and especially the aesthetics of things, is very geometric driven for that reason.
Yeah, that's true. Because, like, if you go to, like, Cambodia, like, where everything's like the Ramayans, like, written on the walls of the temples, it's all like figures. And you see the same thing in Christian architecture as well.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's apparent in Judaism, but definitely, there's a lot more idolatry in pretty much all the other faiths.
Yes, and in Islam, at least, there's like a hyper anti-idolatry
that exists in
our faith, if that makes sense. So in the whole avoidance of that, that's why you have
why you don't see a lot of Muslim comics.
also honestly, possible.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of.
Or, you know, it's all of our parents going like, no, you can't do that as a career.
Actually, yeah, it's more the latter than anything now. Yep. It's like, no, how are you going to make money off of that? Okay.
So I guess the question I want to ask you guys is, I mean, I think we all kind of like randomly discovered this book in different ways. Like I kind of like networked with the artist and found out she was making a book and got so excited about the book she was making that I had to read it. And I couldn't put this down. I've actually now read it twice. It just, it felt so textured. That's kind of like, other than the, like the story and the plot, there's just like so much love and attention to detail in this book that I couldn't put down.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. I came across this on Twitter, Muslim Twitter. And
it is a thing.
It is 100%. It's a thing. I mean, like Black Twitter, Asian Twitter, Muslim Twitter, it's all there. So yeah,
owned by Elon Musk.
I know. Let's not talk about that. Let's not talk about it. Only good vibes. Okay. Only good vibes right now. So yeah.
Democracy dies in the darkness, Lena. Yeah.
Yep. So on Twitter and Instagram and also now TikTok, I just really enjoy following different artists. And they're not necessarily comic book artists. They could be like painting, sculpting, whatever it is. I don't know. I think I just, especially when people post videos of like a time lapse of them creating something, I think something about that is very soothing to me or whatever. So I follow a lot of different illustrators and artists and stuff. And I can't remember how exactly I started following Sarah Alfaji, but somehow I just kind of came across her work and I really loved it. And then once I saw her kind of promoting her book and that the cover of the book, honestly, I was just like, oh, this is so cool. And it reminded me also of a lot of young adult books that I read as a kid. Like there was a series of books by Tamara Pierce. And I think the series is called like The Song of the Lioness or something. And it's about this girl who wants to become a knight. But in that world, girls aren't allowed to become knights or anything. And she has a twin brother who he does not want to become a knight. And so she kind of like switches spots with him and he goes off to become a wizard or something. And she goes off and pretends to be exactly. And she pretends to be a boy and becomes a page, a squire, etc. And like goes up through the ranks and only a certain few people know that she's a woman. And anyway. It's a whole thing.
But with this, there's like this unapologetic nature. There's none of that Mulaning. Most of the major characters are females. So it's like, no, it's more of a socioeconomic commentary.
Yes.
Like the hero's journey.
I actually wanted to bring that up because I love that about Squire. There are certain, you know, TV shows or books or movies where I appreciate the acknowledgement of sexism. And I'm like, yes, let's talk about this because this sucks. But for some reason, going into this graphic novel, I just really liked that that wasn't a thing. And like sexism was not the issue we're dealing with here. We're dealing with colonialism and oppression of other kinds. But I don't know. I thought that was really refreshing. And I was ready for it. You know, the moment I realized like, oh, that's not going to be a issue. Great. Awesome. Let's get into this.
One thing I've always loved about, or since I've, you know, got to know and appreciate who Sarah Alfaji is, but like her bio literally says a bunch of stuff that she's done. And it's like, well, that's cool and all. Sarah really just wants to draw girls with swords. That's it.
Yep. I read that on the book too. And I love that.
Yeah. It was very much of a like, yeah, no, that's, I don't know. I read that and I just didn't even blink at it. I'm like, yeah, that's a totally legit interest to have and hobby to have. Like it just didn't reading that. It just felt so natural, especially after reading this book where it was like, oh yeah, no, yeah, yeah, no. I just assumed you wanted to draw girls with swords. Like it was such a perfect description. It didn't even faze me.
Yeah. Exactly.
And like there's so much to dive into about like the plot itself, but like, and the twist or the kind of reveal at the end of like what this book is really about, it's not the hero's journey. in a way, like, she's not the chosen one necessarily, even though it seems like that is what this book's about. But whether it's commenting on empires and the military, because it's like, you know, in Western militaries, you know, all volunteer armies like we have in the United States, it's, there's a lot of marketing to poorer people, like, hey, join the military, here's your chance. And between that and the kind of like thinly veiled, hey, Ottoman Empire stuff, like, I was like, okay, so you're commenting on the past and the present. Well, nicely done.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. Go ahead, Iman.
See, I was actually, there is a lot of Ottoman Empire stuff in here, but I was actually picking up on a lot of, so, okay.
It was mostly the hats for me, Iman. That was.
I'm going to channel my inner Ryan, you know, shout out to missing Ryan.
Oh, is this the part of the podcast where you start shitting on the book completely?
Yes and no. I can only do so much, Ryan, but it is going to come out a little. All right. The big weakness of this story that I felt was insufficient world building. Okay. And there's a reason why I felt that. It's actually, and this is the part where I start to move away from my inner Ryan. The authors teased so much. I wanted more. All
yes.
Right? There's all of this beautiful artwork that touches out to different parts of this world. However, I didn't get the sense that there was a fully fleshed out history of this world. Or if there was, it wasn't touched on enough. In terms of, now channeling my inner Iman, I got a lot of actually Roman Empire vibes from this. And certain things were callbacks to how the Mongol army used to operate. And I absolutely, absolutely loved that the template for the barracks where the training of the recruits was happening was basically the ruins of Petra. All right. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, so Petra was this huge center of trade.
Is it Petra or Petra?
Petra. It's in Syria.
Petra.
Yeah.
Petra.
It doesn't exist anymore, but
well, I mean,
as of the last 5 years, unfortunately.
You can still visit it. It's on my bucket list.
No. Like, I have visited it. It's, it's just been bombed to all shit in the last 5 to 10 years. Anyway, sorry.
On that depressing note.
I was thinking about Petra and Jordan.
Oh, no, I'm thinking Palmyra. I'm going to shut up for a second.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking
Petra. Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, wait. Yeah,
Petra and Jordan. Petra and Jordan. So
because that's like the first thing. That first building is Petra. And what's hilarious is they get into the inside and like, it's so disappointing. It's just a cave. And that's actually what happens when you're at Petra.
Yes.
I feel like we should put a disclaimer on this episode. Like, clearly none of us are Arabs. everyone. But go on, Iman.
So the thing about Petra is that when it was actually a thriving civilization, and it has currently not yet been bombed to dust, it was actually a huge trading center. So if you go to different museum exhibits that are displaying things from Petra, you'll see pieces of architecture, you know, that have been removed, like pillars that have fallen apart, that take cultural themes from all over the world, from India to Africa. Mm-hmm. And you'll see writing from everywhere. So there was a huge blend of different cultures happening at this, what we suspect was a major trading hub. So there was this little callback, you know, right at the beginning where it was like, we're doing this in this building from back in the day for you to remember when our
military... It represents what this empire once was,
To represent what this empire once was. And, you know, that also then immediately made me think of how the Mongol army operated. You know, this is the largest land empire the world has ever known. And it was truly a multicultural army. Genghis Khan, after he, you know, did his initial thing and started to expand, bringing in new bodies, bringing in more soldiers to expand his armies, to continue the expansion, it included everybody. They really did not care who you were, where you were from. You just had to fight. And because of that, they ruled the world from China to Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. I bet they still didn't include women though, right?
I'm trying to think. I am not sure about that actually, but I have a feeling that they did not care if you were a man or a woman. They might have cared after they took over China, because the Chinese had a lot, Confucian philosophy has a lot of ideas behind and thoughts around people's roles in society. Everybody has a place and a role.
Sweet way to put it, Aman.
I'm losing out on words here. I'm doing the best I can with the vocabulary I have. But I do know that like in early Islam, you know, there were a lot of women who fought in the army, in the front lines and everything.
Yeah.
You know, they were there, but a lot of limitations existed. I mean, you know, not to go down this sexist rant or anything like that, but, you know, like not a lot of women, because some women had to actually raise the kids because technology had not caught up to allow for completely equitable distribution of labor.
Right.
One thing that you commented on, and I am actually torn on this, is the world building in this is so good. And, you know, these guys like a lot of the same fantasy and geek stuff that we like. I mean, I come back to like Avatar The Last Airbender, which is something I know Sarah has, I think Sarah and Nadia actually teamed up for some work for Free Comic Book Day with it. But it's this fully built out world. And this is like one episode or one season in that world. And I don't know if this is a one and done. It sounds like it is. But because the world is so thoughtfully rendered and based on the texture of everything is so real, you could set a lot of stuff in this universe. They just chose to set one book. Is this book one as a one and done? Or is this book one of many where either you're going to follow this kind of band of misfits through the world, or you're going to see other people, like what happened with that empire, where is it going, or even the Ornu people, right? So
that's I the moment I finished this book, I was like, where's book two? I also felt like it was a good setup too for the next story, you know, or whatever the next adventure they're gonna go on. It was,
but you know, there's a saying, Lena, that's like, you're supposed to, you never want to be at the party when people wish you had left. You want to leave the party when everyone wishes you were still staying around, you know, and I'm butchering it, but I feel like that's what this book did, but I think they did it too soon.
Yeah.
Or they didn't spend long enough here.
Or, I mean, you know, I could see this being a really strong trilogy even. Like, I mean, if they obviously don't want to go on, you know, keep doing it forever, but I really hope they do more. I'm really hoping for it.
on a bit of a tangent, something I've been exploring, you know, a lot of comic creators are moving over to Substack, and Jonathan Hickman, who, you know, did a lot of work on Avengers, Fantastic Four, and X-Men most recently, he's got a Substack called something like, I'm going to actually have to look this up, John Hickman Substack. But the name of his work is Three Worlds, Three Moons. And if you subscribe to his Substack, he's like writing out all the architecture, all the world building. And once he's kind of written his Bible, so to speak, he basically is letting other creators come into the world and do whatever they want with it. And, you know, Lucasfilm is kind of doing that as well, sort of, to a degree. And that's kind of what I want. So even if Sarah and Nadia are done, which I hope they're not, it's just such a rich world that I want more of.
Yeah, that would be, that would be amazing too.
So I agree and disagree with you both at the same time. I agree in the sense of like, yes, I wanted more, but I think, at least for me, within the pages of the book, I feel like there were opportunities to tease more about a broader history in this world that they didn't, and I wish they had. And I think that would have made it even more enticing for us to want a book two.
But I don't think you have to, Aman, because I think it's just enough for them to pull the veil over our eyes and be like, we're actually talking about your world, guys. You know, all of this commentary, yes, these are like fictional characters, but it's used to veil a commentary on the world as it stands today. Colonialism, military for poor people, et cetera, et cetera. What, who, his, something Nadia writes in her essay on the back is like, when history is told to you, like, you really should pay attention to who's telling you the history. And I was like, right. Oh, yeah, because that's the story these peasants are being told about the military and about the might of the empire.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, my criticism of this book is that was the one criticism I had. And I had to fish for it.
So did either of you have a favorite character or favorite scene?
The general at the end, where she's talking about, and this is very much of like my moment of like, I love that line from Darth Vader type of thing. She's definitely and very clearly the bad guy of this story, but she has this awesome at the end where she's talking about her role in making sure that this empire, which keep not knowing how to pronounce it, the Baji.
Yeah, that's on you guys.
The Bait Saji.
Bait Saji. Ramin, you know neither of us speak Arabic, right?
Yeah, three non-Arabs.
Yeah, really.
None of us speak Arabic.
Three non-Arabs. That sounds like a 90s band. Anyway.
That would be a great band name.
When she's talking about her role in maintaining the longevity of the Bait Saji Empire, all right, I absolutely loved that part because to me, it spoke not only about, you know, how it's so easy for to do bad things for what are in your eyes the right reasons, but also it brought to mind for me about how a lot of standing armies have had to operate in the past. So the Ottoman Empire, for example, with the Janissaries, that was, at least at the time, the only standing army that existed at during that time in the world, during the Mongol, when the Mongol Empire was expanding greatly. All of these militaries that have had standing armies have had to continue to conquest because their entire economy ends up being based on continued expansion, continued military action. And when that is the basis on which your economy is surviving, you have to take action to keep that going. I mean, it's the same sort of thing that drove colonial Europe ended up becoming colonial Europe because they had a zero-sum economy. If you have if the other guy has something, it means that I don't have it, you know? And so colonialism was a way for them to get around that. If you weren't in the game of colonialism, you were not going to have what the other guy was getting, you know? And so I really liked that moment because it referenced so many different things and systems in history all crammed into just these couple of pages. That was my favorite moment.
Yeah, and that's what it was. It wasn't characters so much, Lena. I think it was moments. Like I fell in love with the characters. I related to them. I you know, you laugh with them and you cry with them, and there's so many hilarious moments that are kind of like almost cartoony driven, but and they're just like little beats that are great that again really make you fall in love with these characters, but it's like statements that like punctuate the moments. But I dog-eared a few pages, you know. I mean, there's like a long conversation that Aiza is having with, who is this that she's having this moment with? That's the funny thing. I actually don't know who the character she's talking to in it. Is it the general? Is it someone else? But she's talking to, it's right after she's achieved squiredom, and the general's telling her, you know, you need an idea, an ideology. History is that and more. History is the story you tell about yourself, which that sounds all fine and good. But that's propaganda speaking. But you're in the moment. She's achieved this great thing. And, you know, you fast forward just further down in the book, and I'm like jumping around to dog-eared pages, you know, when her kind of mentor, the former knight without an arm, he's like saying, this isn't the way the world works, girl. And she's like, but the world is only how we make it. So how will you make it? And that's her convincing this old guy to like step back up. And there's just like these really charged emotional moments. I could like hear the John Williams score underneath it. Yeah. Anyway, my emotions were manipulated. I'm a sap for that kind of stuff.
Yeah. My favorite actually was that relationship. I love any relationship that involves a cranky old person and a young whippersnapper. Like, I'm all for that. Like, and I love when they teach each other things, you know, and push each other. And because obviously her mentor had a lot to teach her, but, you know, she also got him to do something he never would have on his own. So, yeah, that was, I really liked the different relationships. Even the, what was the, like, redheaded girl who
the really burly one, the like strong girl.
At first I was like, ooh, is she gonna be a bully, like she's gonna be her nemesis or something, but then they're just part of the same group and they hang out together. And so
that's what made the turn so dark, when all of her friends turned against her, right?
Yes.
And it's no matter how close they were, once they found out she was Ornu, I mean, they regret it later on, but they talk shit about their friend, like, for a good portion of the book.
And that's very real, right? I mean, that happens all the time. I mean, think about just even now. Like, I mean, I don't know. I feel like when it comes to people's even political ideologies right now in this country, I mean, if, you know, you were to find out someone very close to you is like a Trumper, or, you know, vice versa, someone's like a huge liberal, whatever, you know, like people turn on each other so quickly. And I feel like we've seen so much of that in recent years.
Well, it's about the assumptive beliefs and propaganda. And I mean, I want to bite my tongue, because I do think, I mean, like, as a card carrying, like, you know, progressive Southern Poverty Law Center member, it's like, hey, if you support this, you're literally supporting things that really don't like my people. And it is something I genuinely, like, kind of struggle with to a degree, right? Mm-hmm. The book Good Talk talks about that. Like, Mira Jacob, the author, talks about her struggle with her in-laws who are Trumpers, because if you support this, you believe this man. And that's not what the kind of Ornu bias was, right? The Ornu bias was flat out racism. It was like, oh, those people are dirty. Yes. And like, there was like, you know, quasi racist jokes against her people. And that's why she hid it. That's why she had to be duplicitous. And then once it's revealed that she was duplicitous, it still comes back to bite her in the ass. And it just, you feel for that. So I don't know. Again, one of those things where I was just like really, really triggered by it. Because I don't think we've had to experience that. Although maybe you're right, Lena. We are kind of seeing that, regardless, right or wrong, like this divisive perception. Right? Perception is our reality.
Mm-hmm. Where you just assume, once you know one aspect of a person, you just assume that you know everything about their personality, everything about their life experiences. And yeah.
Well, because of all the narratives in the culture, right?
Like, exactly.
What the government and the army was saying about the Ornu people, if you say it enough times, people are going to believe it. That's how propaganda works.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, at the same time, you know, I feel like this still very much does exist in our world. I mean, maybe I'm...
Wait, maybe racism's over, Aman. Come on.
Now we're so over that.
I was more thinking about Islamophobia, you know? I think that maybe we're far enough removed now from the events of 9/11, but for me, I very actively remember when I was younger thinking about, like, okay, I need to really put on my news anchor voice so that people who are suspicious of Muslims, don't like Muslims, or really buy into the propaganda, that they're thrown off by my accent, by my very heavy Midwestern accent.
Yeah, you become I like, even as a brown bearded person in the South back then, it's like I was the nicest guy at the airport. You know, when I'd come back from backpacking trips, I'd pack a collared shirt and a razor to like not be bearded. So I'd be smiling at the Atlanta airport.
Yeah, because it's a sense you have to, you're fighting an uphill battle simply based on what you look like and whatnot. And I think that still exists to a certain extent, you know? I mean, when you hear stories that the military is using the movie 300, you know, to play for the recruits, like that's, now you're fighting that exact same kind of thing that's being portrayed in Squire.
And what's interesting is, so I think growing up, again, in a very post 9/11 world and dealing with Islamophobia. Like, Aman, I think you had to figure out how to not seem so threatening as a man. And as a woman, for me, I felt like I had to struggle to be seen, period. And, you know, where, you know, and this is just the case, I think, with a lot of women across all kinds of cultures, where women are just seen as so non-threatening, non-whatever, you know, like just, you don't have anything to say or anything to offer. And so, I like, I definitely, you know, like people coming up to me saying things like, oh, I didn't know you were funny. Okay.
Yeah, because you're not allowed to be, right? Like,
you didn't think I had a personality. Cool. Awesome. Like, I mean, it's just, things like
that. Don't you listen to my podcast?
I know, for real.
I mean, Lena, to be fair, I still don't think you're funny.
Okay, but you're just my mean big brother, okay? That's why.
But, you know, Seinfeld actually had a quote. He's like, he doesn't understand. Seinfeld was like, I don't understand racism because why hate a whole group of people for one big reason when there's lots of individual reasons to hate a person?
Yeah, really. Honestly, though.
It took everything in me for my comment to be that personal statement and not the first thing that was coming to mind, which was a theory amongst historians about why the Roman Empire fell, which is...
And why is that, Aman?
One theory is that as the Roman Empire was expanding, their army was stretched thin. And so they had to bring in more people who were not Roman into the ranks, which eroded military discipline as well as the drive to expand.
Quote, the kind of nationalism built into it, right?
Exactly, exactly. And so if you think about that time and fall really more of the Western Roman Empire, you know, and you are in a military and there are colonists, colonials, or, you know, not, what am I thinking of? You know, people who have conquered territories joining your elite military, you know, this, that scene also, I feel like where her friends all of a sudden, where Aiza's friends all of a sudden are suspicious of her, think she was a spy, feel like they lied to her. You know, it's also this built in like, oh, you know, this is somebody who comes from a group of people who does not believe in the greatness of the homeland, you know? And if you look at it that way, I mean,
what's interesting, but what's interesting is Aiza did it. Aiza did it. Aiza was in it for the opportunity, kind of the reason a lot of people joined the military.
Yeah.
She wasn't in it for the nation building.
Yeah. Yeah, true. She wanted to be a hero.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, yeah.
I think, well, I mean, maybe that was it. I mean, that was the marketing of like the flyer that she saw, but it really was like she wanted to escape her station in life.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. But so much of that propaganda was, I think, subconsciously affecting her, where she didn't realize it. And so much of that happens now. If you look at, if you see ads for the U.S. Army, like,
be all you can be.
Yeah, like, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's so dramatic. Like, cue John Williams music. And so, yeah, there's a lot of that. And they'll pay for your college tuition. That's a huge one. You know,
that is a big one.
Yeah.
Although a lot of some of the branches I've heard have cut back on that. And I'm specifically thinking of the Marines because they really don't want people who are just in there for the college tuition. I mean, think about that for a second. The U.S. Marines, I don't know if this is still true, but at one point they eliminated the tuition benefits because they felt that it would tarnish the commitment of the people choosing to enlist in the Marines.
So the GI Bill doesn't fully apply then?
The GI Bill is mostly for veterans, not for
recruits. So once you leave service, got it.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
It's so interesting about this idea of national service, right? Because say what you will. So, you know, in America, we are an all-volunteer service. And to your point about like college tuition being a motivator, in a lot of European countries, colleges, if you make the grades, you can kind of get it and the state will cover it. And then kind of flipping on its head, however you feel about Israel, you know, you have this compulsory military service, which is just about service to nation and cause. And as a result, that drives a deeper nationalism because everyone has a part, and even a reticence to deploy the military sometimes because everyone knows someone in it right now or someone's right. been in it. So I'm really conflicted of like, what is the right play for service and specifically like military service? Because, you know, it's kind of like, if you have a hammer, you're going to want to use it. That's kind of the military industrial complex. So
yes,
but at the same time, like we are so removed from our wars in this country because it's a different, so for the most part, it's a different socioeconomic strata that fights our wars for us nowadays. Unlike in Vietnam, when it was like everyone knew someone who was in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there are two big things to keep in mind. For most countries, you know, like South Korea, Taiwan, they also have compulsory military service. If you are South Korean, you are not just South Korean by citizenship. You're also South Korean by ethnicity, by race. Same thing with being French or German. The US is very unique in the sense that if you are American, it really doesn't have anything to do, as much as some people may try to make it that way, it really has nothing to do with what your ethnicity is. It purely is citizenship and where and how you were born and mostly raised. Yeah. You know? So whether
although also right the amount of fast food answer, that you eat.
I'm sorry?
Also the amount of fast food you eat.
Yes. That's a big one.
Can I interject and just say that everything you're saying is true, but I think it's funny how it's been put in practice historically, whereas, you know, Black Americans who were serving in the army were definitely treated as non-American or, you know, less than obviously in their service.
Yeah, while they're in the service, Tuskegee, right? And then obviously when they came back.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you on that, but I'm talking purely about Ruman, what you said about what the right call is to sort of create a sense of nationalism and shared identity. Mm-hmm. These different circumstances for different countries means that the solution or what the right answer is different.
Well, and I mean, if you look at Taiwan, South Korea, and Israel, like, in the national identity, again, rightly or wrongly, there is a sense of kind of, I don't want to say siege mentality, but they're kind of all kind of living on a contested border, right? Yeah. With a relatively small population.
We did pick those specific examples that happen to have that in common, but there are other countries that that are not actively under a siege right now, or have for some reason a siege mentality.
I couldn't think of them.
Like Sweden has a compulsory military service.
Sweden? Wow.
I'm pretty sure Finland does as well, but I think Finland probably has a little bit closer to a siege mentality, given that they have been invaded by Russia multiple times.
Given that they are petitioning to join the EU as we speak.
And NATO.
I don't know why.
And
we completely left the world of Squire.
Well, did we though? I mean, all of these things speak to, you know, this core question of recruits to a military and trying to recruit people into a standing military who are not sort of part of the core, quote unquote, of the empire to be served.
Well, and I mean, that's the whole book, right? The whole book is kind of, it tricks you, right? It's like, it's this hero's journey to become a squire, to become a knight, to become a citizen. And by the latter third of the book, it just kind of flips it on its head. It's like, oh no, that's not what this is about. This is about how that's the wrong mentality.
Yeah.
Still,
that's probably like the most brilliant part of the book.
Yeah. I still do like how they really stuck to how Sarah and Nadia really kept Aiza's hero's journey throughout, you know, it just doesn't end up where you think it's going to end up. She ends up a hero at the end.
Well, it'd be like if Star Wars started out with Luke. Oh, he kind of did, right? Luke Skywalker, I don't know if you want to join. He did want to join the Rebellion always, but it'd be like if Star Wars started with Luke wanting to join the Empire to be a TIE fighter pilot, and he fell into all the propaganda of the Empire, and then by the end of it, he's like the rebel hero. right? And that's not quite what these three are going to do at the end of the, or these three or four are going to do at the end of the book. They're, in fact, if anything, she like tells her mentor, like, no, we're going off the grid. We're out of here.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's more like Han Solo's journey, if you think about it.
No Wookiees in this book, though. I mean, that's what this book needed.
Wookiees!
A furry mascot.
No. No. It had everything perfectly.
But no, Han Solo got turned away.
Well, you could argue her mentor is the furry mascot, so.
That's true, I guess, yeah.
I mean, Han Solo got turned down from the Stormtrooper Academy.
Oh, this is true.
And then he ended up being a smuggler, and then ended up being part of a rebellion and a rebel hero.
So you're saying Squire Volume 2 is she becomes a smuggler?
Yes.
Ooh, but you know what's interesting? To be a little more serious, that's probably where I see they're going to be living on the fringes, these four people. And they'll reluctantly probably do the right thing, you know, Kung Fu or Usagi Yojimbo style. Kind of, they're almost like wandering Ronin.
I'm laughing because I want to read that story so badly right now. Squire Book 2, where Aiza and friends are Samurai Sevening the shit out of everything.
That would be amazing. I would watch the shit out of that if that turned into a TV show at some point, which I hope it does.
Right?
I also want Squire in general to turn into some sort of animated show.
You know, I'm of such like mixed feelings. Like the older I get, I'm more of a purist of stick to the medium. Like I don't, I mean, look, I want Sarah and Nadia to get all the things. So like, cool, make it a cartoon. Go for it. Make that rich, that IP money. But in reality, like, I just want more of these books. Like, you know, it's like, it's beautifully told, the pacing, it works in the medium. This is what the medium's about. Like, it's, and this is where it mixes, you know, YA, action, very progressive, unapologetic. Yeah, girls is the hero. Like, I want, when my daughter's older, I want her to read this. Because, and political commentary, like, subterfuge and political commentary. Like, it's the real deal. It's the full package. So I'm just really happy that this book is out.
Yeah, for it's sure.
Fantastic. And looking at the cover, I think I've been here.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is a set of pillars on the coast of Turkey.
Ooh.
Near...
Are you sure?
No, I'm not 100% sure. I'm going to have to look at old pictures from 2000, before Sarah was born, apparently, to see if this is actually the same place. But I'm pretty sure I've been here. And that's awesome.
That'd be really cool. I'm pretty sure she got all of the imagery and the scenes and landscapes are inspired from places she went to in Jordan, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, that was kind of like one thing she told us in the interview. It's like, yeah, as a child, she was traveling around and taking pictures and drawing and almost like collecting reference material her whole life for this book. So
awesome. I think in shout out to Modern Minorities for interviewing Sarah, I think she said there that she got reference materials from Turkey and Jordan. So,
Cool. Yeah. Cool.
I think
someone did their homework.
Yeah, for real.
And it was Sarah.
Well, I had to. Yes. It was Sarah, yes. But yeah, I think I've been
here. Guys, I gotta ask you guys a fundamental question we like to ask folks on Quarantine Comics, and would you recommend this book to someone? And while I think the answer is yes, I guess who would you recommend this book to?
I would recommend this book to someone who has no idea about Arab history or, you know, or who kind of just draws a blank slate when they think of, you know, various empires in the Middle East. So
what about you, Aman?
I would recommend, and yes, obviously I would recommend this book, but I would recommend it to two kinds of anybody who has any kind of an interest with, you know, knights, tales, heroes, journey stuff, because this is exactly that kind of story. It's just in a different setting, and chances are they'll get just as much out of it. The other person I would recommend it to is somebody who is a history buff on old school empires and things like that, because at least for me, I got a lot out of this book because of my pre-existing interest in how the Ottoman military functioned as compared to the Roman military, as compared to the Mongol military. I mean, the callback to this one time years ago, I went to, you know, a museum exhibit that was showing artifacts from Petra, you know, like all of that stuff. It just brought so much. And I got so much out of it because I already had the interest in all of these things and the shout outs in this book to that. So I would recommend it to people who know everything about those old empires and civilizations, and also to people who know nothing about it and purely have an interest in heroes' journeys, knights' tales.
I like, Aman, how your tactic is like, give it to the nerds. And mine was like, here, learn something.
Yeah, you guys had like way more sophisticated answers than me, because I'm like, I just want every 10-year-old boy and girl to read this book. It should be required reading in middle school.
I want every kid to read this book.
I think it's for kids, you know, who have no exposure to stuff or who have only been exposed to, you know, Middle Eastern or... what am I saying? Middle Ages, yeah, Europe, but, knights' tales, you know?
Imagine if this was the first knight's book that they read, right? We have all the baggage from all the other shit we've read, but what if this was the first one? And I say that because of literally all of the like socioeconomic commentary. Like, what if this was the first thing you can inject in? Oh, crap, I just got this book banned, I'm sure.
Oh, God.
Squire, not popular in Tennessee.
No, but really, this book could, even if, you know, some kid, you know, even if they have been exposed to like the Roman Empire and Middle Ages and all that, like this book could spark an interest in other kinds of histories and empires, I think, for a kid.
Yeah, I mean, you know what's really interesting to me about having a knight's tale in this setting of pseudo Ottoman, you know, fictional Ottoman / Mongol / you know, Muslim civilization eras, is that the knight's tales that we are typically used to of the Middle Ages, that was the crap global military. This is the same story told at like kind of the same fictional time in a context where the military was top of the world. The Dark Ages in Europe were not the Dark Ages everywhere else. Hmm. But all the knight's tales that we read is basically from the Dark Ages. Europe was not a power of any kind. That was the backwater that nobody wanted to go to for vacation. Okay?
That's truly my favorite like thing to learn about is, okay, like, you know, what was going on in a totally different part of the world when this was happening? Like when Queen Elizabeth I was ruling, okay, England was crap. It was
disease was everywhere.
It was disgusting. It was truly it, and it was one Protestant nation surrounded by a whole bunch of Catholic nations. They had no friends in Europe, England at that time. And the one of the biggest reasons that, you know, they survived really is because of the ties that Queen Elizabeth and the, you know, the trade, whatever routes and stuff that she established with like the Ottoman Empire, with the Mughal Empire. And by the way, at that time, you know, while she was reigning and people had no clue about anything related to hygiene in England, the Mughal Empire had like fountains of water everywhere. You know, they had like everything was glorious and beautiful, gardens flowing and blah, blah, blah. Everyone's educated. Well, not everyone, but you know what I mean. So it's so interesting to think about what a totally different part of the world geographically was like. What, you know, at the same time as like sometime something happening in Europe that we've learned so much about in our history classes, but never learned about that other part of the world.
Yeah. There's back into comic books, like there's in Neil Gaiman's Sandman, there's one issue that takes place in the Middle East. And the one thing is kind of like Gaiman is a little bit Eurocentric, but it's just like the contrast for what the ancient world was like in the Middle East versus that. And it's like one of the few times I've seen kind of pop culture other than like Disney and Aladdin, I guess. But again, it's contrasting kind of what the surrounding kind of Eurocentric world was like versus the Middle East. You don't see that a lot in pop culture.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
If anything, I feel like the cultural backdrop of Squire actually makes this more relevant reading, I think, for young Americans, because the story takes place amongst a superpower.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And not
why are we fighting? Why do we think we're fighting? And why we think we're enlisting? Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the territory of Guam has like the highest percentage population of veterans in the US military, you know? And this is for an island that doesn't even have the right to vote in US elections, you know? And I feel like this is the just purely based on the backdrop that Sarah and Nadia chose for their book, I feel like it may be the same story, but just changing that backdrop makes it so much more relevant to the questions that young Americans are more likely to face or come across, I think.
Well, I think that's what good fiction does. Specifically, you see it more in sci-fi than fantasy, but it's like, oh, we're not talking about your modern day genocide and racism. We're talking about robots and aliens. And I think that's what this does.
Yeah.
All right, Ruman. So tell me, I know I won't be there, but I want to know, what are you reading next week on Quarantine Comics?
Well, Aman, the funny thing is, we never get it right. We're always a few weeks off. But if you do hear this, you should go check out the comic The Killer from the late 90s. It's a French comic book by the writer Mats and the artist Luc Jacquemin, which follows the life of an initially unnamed assassin. I have no idea what this book's about. This is Ryan's pick, and it's probably going to fuck me up and give me weird dreams. But next week, we're reading all 5 or 6 volumes of Jacquemin and Mats's The Killer.
Wow.
But, that guys,
speechless.
This was so much fun. I love that we had way more like history lesson and political debate.
Yes.
Comic fanboy
and fan to do on Grounded Geeks.
We totally leveled up the pod. Thank you for letting me join in Geek Out. And I'm sorry Ryan had to miss out on this.
I tried to bring him in spirit.
Yes. But
with
we
your
missed
contrarian
you, Ryan.
Nature.
Maybe next time all 4 of us can be chatting. But yes, thank you for joining us, Ruman. We really appreciate it. And
this was a blast.
Yeah. And as always, thanks for listening to Grounded Geeks.
And we'll catch you next week, but without Ruman, unfortunately.